Welcome to the DermVet Podcast. I'm Dr. Ashley Bourgeois, a board-certified veterinary dermatologist practicing in Portland, Oregon with animal dermatology clinics. I'm also a mom of two, just trying to find the balance like everyone else. Let's learn to ditch the itch, cytology, everything, and make derm more fun than frustrating. We've talked about multimodal treatment of atopic dermatitis many times on the podcast and how atopic dermatitis really should be considered almost like a syndrome rather than a singular disease because of how complex it is. But what exactly is the complexity that comes with atopic dermatitis? You know, reading up on atopic eczema, or truly atopic dermatitis in humans, which is where we derive this concept from, atopic dermatitis, it's actual disease that's seen in people. Very different than the traditional allergies that always get mentioned as far as respiratory signs, conjunctivitis, sneezing, with environmental allergies in humans. There truly is atopic dermatitis, atopic eczema. So what are some complexities we can see with that that also can be seen in, let's say, atopic dermatitis in dogs? So I was recently reading some papers about atopic eczema and just seeing some really, really good graphs and information about how complex it really is. Even though we want to make it simple, there's so many different layers to what we're managing. So I just want to go over a few of those layers so that we can really understand how complex atopic dermatitis is in people and very similar for what we see in our pets. So if we look at this vicious cycle that is atopic dermatitis, and very similar to what we talked about last week with barrier function being impaired, we do have that barrier damage. So similar to what we see in dogs, people get abnormal skin barrier, which causes them to allow penetrations of allergens better. But also that dry red skin from that barrier being damaged also can be pruritic on its own. So we get the pruritus associated with having dry skin, which, you know, my family's from Minnesota. When I've been visiting them and it is the dead of winter and say it's like end of January and it's, you know, negative 20 out, if I barely go outside, my knuckles, they get dry and cracked and scaly, right? Just from being exposed to that cold. But as I come inside and it's healing, it can get really itchy. And that's similar to something what we could see with atopic skin as well. It's just that barrier damage not only allows things to come in, but then just the scaly redness becomes itchy on its own. You get chronic inflammation and remodeling that's happening with that, which keeps our immune system very active, but again, can cause some of that pruritus on its own. Then we have Th2 immunity. So as we've discussed with immunotherapy, we know that individuals with atopic dermatitis have an over-response with their Th2 immunity rather than their Th1 immunity. Why is that important? Because Th2 immunity tends to kick off certain cytokines that have the side effects we see with atopic dermatitis. For example, interleukin-31, which has gained a lot of attention in the last, decade since Apoquel and Cytopoint have been out, is a Th2 cytokine. So because those Th2 cytokines can exacerbate those clinical symptoms like pruritus, itch, that is a big deal that dogs with atopic dermatitis have an over-response with their Th2 immunity. And this is similar to what's seen in atopic eczema in people as well. Then you get into, well, why does this happen and what can really trigger these atopic eczema, atopic dermatitis cases from occurring? Genetics, first of all. Of course, we know there's a role in genetics with atopic dermatitis. What's really interesting about genetics is, you can have parents that don't necessarily have signs of atopic dermatitis, but of course they can still carry to some degree genetics associated with that. You know, like our sons had medical issues that neither my husband or I have experienced, but clearly there has to be some sort of genetic trigger that's there. They've done studies looking into, different genetics and the different phenotypes of breeds that we're seeing in some of these pets. Why do we get certain pets that have certain symptoms very classically? So for example, when we think of West Highland White Terriers, if you tell me atopic Westie, I'm automatically thinking of a lichenified yeasty Westie. But why is that? There has to be some different phenotype that we're seeing with some of these genetics and certain breeds. Why do German Shepherds tend to get this ulcerative draining pyoderma, you know, ulcerative dermatitis? They're just like fire engine red on their bellies when they come in with their atopic dermatitis and pyoderma. A lot of them get draining tracts. Why? Why are they different with some of their genetics? Just, you know, filaggrin's gotten a bunch of attention. Filaggrin is a component of the keratinization, cornification aspect. Why? Why do we see these differences? We don't know the answers to a lot of these questions, but we just know genetics obviously play a huge role in why some pets are showing us these symptoms versus not. And then, of course, there's environment, lifestyle. You know, where environment that pet is in. Of course, I've had cases where they move somewhere else and all of a sudden their symptoms are not that bad. You know, we are seeing a lot of pollens, a lot of dust mites, other things that can kind of be prevalent in many areas. These pollens fly for several miles. So often when my patients are moving, they're still having some symptoms. But we know what environment they're in definitely plays a role. You know, are they around a lot of other animals? Similar to the hygiene hypothesis that's in humans. It seems like maybe some pets who spend more time indoors, like could they be more predisposed to allergies just based on maybe they're not getting exposed to a lot when they're younger, whether they're in urban or rural environments. And of course, I have plenty of pets who are in rural environments who have allergies, but these are just certain concepts and things that have been noted as some risk factors we can see with the environment they're in, how much they're exposed, how much their immune system's exposed. It's really interesting. Microbiota. So microbiome's definitely gaining a ton of attention. And what we have seen in studies is sometimes I have clients that come in and say, oh, they're always breaking out with infection. They have so much bacteria in their body as far as different types. But what we're actually seeing with pets, if you look at studies of their microbiome of the skin of a healthy dog and an allergic dog and the microbiome of the ear in a healthy dog and allergic dog, we actually see that healthy dogs tend to have a lot more diversity, a lot more different types of bacteria. So they actually have more, you know, diversity, more species of bacteria. What we're seeing in dogs is where a lot of the research is, but, you know, we would assume we can extrapolate some of this for cats. So cats don't break out as readily with infection with their allergies compared to dogs. But what we definitely see in dogs is that we tend to have an abundance of specific bacteria. So for example, Staph pseudoneuromedius in dogs, in the skin and the ears, we see an overabundance, less diversification with their bacteria. So we have a predominance of Staph pseudoneuromedius, probably playing a role in why we see so many coxoid bacteria infections. Same with the ears. If we look in the fungal side, right, it's normal for us to have some fungus on us, but we know that dogs and their skin and their ears that have atopic dermatitis, their microbiome has an abundance of Malassezia pachydermatis. And it's not having as diverse a bacteria compared to pets who do not have atopic dermatitis. And then there's so many different things that feed into with the innate immunity and the adaptive immunity. Of course, we think of things like the deviation towards a Th2 response, which is what we're trying to correct with things like immunotherapy, and also why we're trying to get more specific with actually identifying what types of things they're allergic to. And historically, we've probably gotten a lot of false positives in some of our serum tests with allergies, and we're seeing other things like molecular allergology with the Nexmune PAX test come out and try to really adapt to that, because maybe they're not as allergic to as many things as we've traditionally thought, and we'll still see as we get more and more information collected. But we get allergen memory, so many things that feed into that adaptive immunity. And of course, there's that innate immunity that has a role here as well. So many different factors, and that's why we're often really, really trying to talk about the multimodal approach to managing these cases. instead of just putting them on one medication, you know, utilizing topical therapy. You know, if we can nutritionally help their skin barrier through some of these skin diets, even if they don't have a food allergy, that can be really beneficial. If we can use topicals that help to restore that skin barrier, so hopefully the microbiome is better. You know, if we can lessen how many infections that these pets are getting. If we can use immunotherapy to shift the way that they're responding to these things so that long term we don't see things like progression of disease, which we know is very common in our allergic pets. And just really trying to think of them and that whole cascade, outside, inside, inside, outside, so that we can really make them comfortable and really manage them long term the best way that we can, because we already know this is, again, a complex disease. It's almost like a syndrome because so many factors play into it. Genetics, different breed phenotypes. You know, we have everything from dogs who come in and they're really not that itchy, but they just break with infection as their allergies progress. We have some dogs that are super itchy and they don't really get infected, but they're so pruritic just from their primary allergy. And then of course we have all the dogs that are in between those two. So it's just really important for us to really consider the complexity of this disease process, how much information that we need to be collecting from owners regarding the history, but also what they are capable of doing at home and what their expectations are, so that we can set this up in a way that makes sense for them from a financial aspect, but also a bandwidth aspect, like what can they handle doing at home right now, and never really judging, because you never know the people who really jump into a lot of these things, even if you don't suspect that they would be the ones. So it is really, really as simple as we want to make allergies, it's not. And so we want to be thinking of all of these things and how to set our patients up for success, but also educating owners and not necessarily jumping to everything we talk about now, because that's overwhelming. But just making sure they understand, like, step by step, there's a lot going on here. Let's see what works. But it's going to take some time for us to really develop a, you know, concrete plan for your pet, and knowing that we're still going to probably have to deal with flares in the future, but we really hope to manage it so they're not quite as severe, not quite as frequent, and so that overall we can tell that they're doing better with this really difficult, complex disease.